Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willisher, host at Podcast UFO. I want to thank you for joining the show this evening. I'm really excited about our guest. I met Charlie Foltz about 4 or 5 years ago when he was up in Maine at a conference. Great guy. I met him along with Jim Weiner, both from the Allagash abduction. We're going to be talking all about that. And I want to thank everyone that supports the show. Oh, I should say Alejandro Rojas is coming up before that with the UFO updates. And where the Allagash, someone wrote me, where is the Allagash? I mean, you can look on the map or Google it, but I live in what's called Midcoast Maine, which takes a while to get to from the New Hampshire border. I don't know, a few hours. It's not exactly in the middle of nowhere. But I looked on the map today, and I did, a search, and it's a 5.5 hour drive from where I live, and I think it is exactly in the middle of nowhere. It's way the heck up in Maine, near the Canada border in the center of Maine, and it's quite a place. There was someone living in that area for something like 20 years without any human contact, and that was within the last I think he came out of the woods 5 or 6 years ago. There's really not a lot going on in that area. And let's see, I want to do just a couple of shout outs. Supporter Nicholas Lazarus, he wanted me to say hi, and anyone that supports the show, you can send me an email, I'll give you a shout out. Also Kelly, who is sick in bed but said that she's still going to listen to the show. So I hope you feel better. And just in the last 24 hours, I had a couple of power outages, and hopefully that won't happen. And the reason is I got some heavy snow up here in Maine. And so all day long, the snow's been sliding off the roof and making a loud crash. It sounds like it's the end of the world. So if you happen to hear that, it's not the end of the world. So we're okay. And I guess I am ready to bring in the one and only Alejandro Rojas. How are you?
Hello, my friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How have you been? I trust you have no snow in Arizona, right?
No snow. Yeah. Yay. In fact, at Open Minds, one of the people that we work with, some of you may remember her, Heather, if you went to the UFO Congress, she has a company called No Snow out here where she rents out paddle boards. But yep, it's a big saying out here for those of us very happy not to be dealing with snow ever in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to shovel rain, right?
Yes. I've had enough of that in my life.
Right. Right. So what's going on in the UFO world?
All right. So I do want to say, because I was just looking at what the first story I'm going to talk about, which I'm very proud of, but I'm also very proud of at Open Minds on our YouTube. We have a video that's extremely popular. It keeps getting, so many hits. And that is our short little documentary on the Allagash. Right. And it was, Michael Klein helped put together some of my interviews. But also, of course, some of these interviews were at the International UFO Congress, so everybody who helped out with that. So we all worked really hard to put that together, and we're really, really proud of that piece, and I'm so happy that so many out there are enjoying it. But I wanted to mention that before your show today.
Yeah, there's 400,000 something views on that, right?
Yeah, and more all the time. I mean, I think our most popular video has been for the last year. John Alexander video and Travis Walton one get a lot of views too. But it's so popular, and I'm happy that so many are getting educated and getting to know these guys through that piece. Right. So I was so proud and so happy that we were able to put that together so people could get to know everybody that was involved with it. Because just kind of like Travis, getting to know these guys is part of understanding, the credibility of these cases.
Right.
So I think a lot of your listeners will find that out during this show. But I'm also very proud of my latest Den of Geek article, which is called Project Blue Book Easter Egg and Reference Guide. Of course, all these stories you can find on the front page of Open Mind TV. But this story, what I did is my editors at Den of Geek, and then I filled in some gaps on some things that I hadn't written reviews on. But we made this big guide for all of the legit cases that were covered in the Project Blue Book Season 1, and some of the Easter eggs, because they referenced real cases that only UFO geeks like us would have gotten. So I also wrote about those, and then I have links to the real Project Blue file, Blue Book files. So it's just a bunch of really great, credible stuff that was covered during the show that others might not be aware of.
Are you having an earthquake there or something?
Yeah, earthquake.
Yeah. Wow.
Actually, just got to tighten the screw there. But, yeah, so I'd love for everybody to check that out now that the show's over. What is your overall? Thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs sideways?
What was the question?
For Project Blue Book, the TV show.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. I realize that it's a fiction, you know, you know, it's loosely based on the real incidents. But overall, I think it's a very captivating show with great characters.
I agree. I'm with you there. I'm totally with you there. And I know some people will be like, no, I hated the show. But I'm with you there. There's a lot of interesting news, actually, that came out this week. Another interesting story was an interview by the Metro with Nick Pope. Now, this is a UK tabloid, and they can get kind of zany. But Nick was saying some really interesting things. He's saying that he was told by witnesses that some people related to, he didn't want to say specifically or for sure Rendlesham, although he alludes to it, say that they had DNA and blood taken, that samples taken by a group who said they were doing some scientific or academic research on people who have had experiences. And of course, in the Rendlesham Forest, they had an incredible UFO experience there, some military guys. Such as John Burroughs and Jim Peniston. And he's saying that he believes that actually these were part of ATIP, or they were part of this government program, but they were not told that when the samples were taken. He's not saying, oh, these guys are all bad and it's this major conspiracy theory. He's going beyond that and saying, we did this in the Ministry of Defense for the UK, that he was personally involved with doing the same sort of thing, saying that, not necessarily lying, just saying this is going to be as part of a scientific research, but just not sharing that. Well, this is scientific research for the Department of Defense or Ministry of Defense, because they call it out there. So really interesting. He even alluded to, actually, I think he sent this to me personally, but I'm going to write about it. And he wrote about it on his tweets that this was even partially due to some psychic testing, some essentially remote viewing sort of programs that they were looking into the UK. So that is a really interesting story that's out there, I think.
Hmm. Wow. That is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, good one. Now, he's not saying he knows for sure. He's just saying we did this in the UK, so I wouldn't be surprised if they did that over here. And some witnesses he's talked to seem to be implying that. But speaking of the remote viewing program, there's a great documentary out there called Third Eye Spies. And it goes over kind of Hal Puthoff, who's working with To the Stars and worked with Bigelow and ATIP and everybody, how he was involved with getting remote viewing started here in the U.S. And this was all started, for the most part, because the government had heard, the military had heard, that the Russians were doing remote viewing. And there's a story out in Newsweek this week. It's called Russia's Paranormal Soldiers and Military Dolphin Telepathy Revealed by Defense Ministry Magazine. So a Russian Defense Ministry Magazine wrote an article about how they had researched things like telepathy and remote viewing and these sort of things. So that's an article that's out in Newsweek. Now, it doesn't seem like the Russians have the same major giggle factor that we have over here. But I kind of feel like the giggle factor is lessening as time goes on and we hear more about these programs.
Yeah.
But really, the public, I still think, still doesn't know how seriously, you know, UFOs and remote viewing was taken by the government. But they're learning more over time. So those were some really good ones. And then one final one I want to touch on. It's another one from a UK tabloid, probably because they'd be the only one to pick it up. But a production person, Robert Kvyat. So some of you might not know his name, but you've definitely seen his programs because he's one of the most prolific UFO program producers, television producers out there. If you start looking at the credits, you'll see his name all over the place. Someone like myself or maybe even Martin, you might have talked to him before. But he is actually suing Ron Pandolfi, who is someone who worked on what has been referred to as the CIA's weird desk, essentially had worked with the CIA on some of their weird unsolved files. But he's saying he had worked on a program with them on anti-gravity, and he's suing because he said they kind of just screwed him over on the funds related to that program. But he's suing them also so he can reveal that the CIA has been involved with disinformation programs in the UFO field. So he says he's going to be able to reveal some of this. He's not really giving us much in the way of details, but yeah, that's another really good one.
That is something. Wow. And he's just throwing the UFOs in there.
Yeah, I guess he's kind of alluding to that. He discovered this sort of stuff when he was working with Pandolfi. But I wonder if this is going to be one of these moments. This happened with William Moore, who was one of the first guys to write about Roswell, who came out and said he actually was part of a disinformation program for like a decade without UFO researchers knowing. So I wonder if Robert Kvyat's going to say, you know, I was actually part of this program. Kvyat, one of the most well-known things he's known for is releasing that hoax Roswell autopsy video. He was an integral part of that. Mm-hmm. He released the video of the autopsy, and then he also did a documentary revealing how it was a hoax.
About
playing both ends there.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah.
Is it Philip Mantle that did a lot of work on that?
Philip Mantle has done a great job on debunking that whole thing and working with the guys who actually made the props and conducted the whole thing. And they kind of got screwed over, actually, because there was this television producer guy who prompted them to do it and was paying them. And then there was this whole fight, you know, as it became... It just became, once Kvyat made the documentary, it became more popular than I think any of them would have known.
Yeah.
It's just extremely famous. Even to this day, I think there may be listeners or as people hear me calling it a hoax that will say, no, it wasn't a hoax, man. But Philip Mantle's done a great job demonstrating that, yes, it was a hoax. And we know who did it and why and all the details behind it at this point.
Yeah. And there was a little bit of cash made there. So
yes.
Yeah. All right, Alejandro. A lot of cash. Thanks so much.
Yep, my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, sure. We'll see you next week.
See ya.
All right, bye-bye. All right, so our guest is Charlie Foltz. And like I said earlier, I met him a number of years ago and also hung out with him out in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's really my pleasure to invite him on this show. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Always a pleasure talking to you. We've had a number of conversations over the years, and always a real pleasure. And Charlie, I have a lot of new listeners to the show. There's a lot of people who are into UFOs, certainly know the story, but there's also a lot of people out there that never, ever heard of it. This is one particular show that I have to tell you that... I actually remember hearing about it years ago when I wasn't even in the UFO topic. I was working somewhere and someone told me about the Allagash up in Maine, which I had already heard of. I've never been there, but they told me about there was an abduction there. And I remember hearing about it and I said, what is that? I had no idea what they were talking about. But it's one of the very few. I never heard about Travis Walton. I never heard a number of things. I did hear of Betty and Barney Hill, but just very few things when I was not really paying attention to the topic. But the Allagash I did hear of. So if you wouldn't mind, Charlie, can you just tell the new listening audience what happened? A lot happened. We do have to take a break about 10 minutes from now, but I'll cut in if I have to and go ahead and fire away.
Well, in 1976, I went on a wilderness excursion trip with some college friends and neighbors. My neighbors were Jack and Jim Weiner, and we had all attended the same college together, and we had planned on taking a canoe trip and northern Maine and climbing Mount Katahdin in the process. One of the people who I met actually when I loaded my gear in the car to drive to Maine was Chuck Rack. He had known Jack from the college, and we spent, as you mentioned earlier, quite a number of hours driving with all of our gear in a Chevy Vega, which is a small automobile.
Yeah.
It was good we were all skinny guys back then, because we wouldn't be able to do it today.
Yeah.
And we arrived in Baxter State Park, which is the beginning or the end of the Appalachian Trail, depending upon which direction you started. Mount Katahdin is the highest mountain in Maine at 13 feet short of one vertical mile. There's a cairn of rocks that actually make it up 1 foot over 1 mile. So,
wow.
Spent a couple of days in Baxter State Park climbing the mountain, then purchasing all the perishable food that we could buy to last us several days into our trip, and drove probably about 40 minutes north of Baxter State Park to a small bush pilot's business, and loaded half of our gear and one canoe strapped to the pontoon of this plane. And Jack and I, that's Jack Wiener and I, took off for Telos Landing, which is the beginning of the Allegash water system. And it's also a national park property. The Allegash was or is one of two rivers which flow north into Canada, or to the was it the St. Francis,
John.
Which
St. John,
excuse yeah. me, which separates Canada from the U.S. But flying into Telos Landing, every group has to register with the wardens so they can check on your itinerary, your provisions, make sure that you're prepared to go on a trip like that. So after Chuck and Jim arrived on the second trip for the pilot, we made camp for the night, and then the following day began our canoe trip. Chuck Rack and I had both had some canoe experience. Chuck had gone on the Allegash once earlier, and so we more or less were intrigued by going on the trip with somebody that had done it before. Well, it took the twins a couple of days to get into canoeing and understanding what they were doing. Mm. And once we had all began working as a group team. Quickly went up Lake Champlain and tried to go up to Allegash Lake, which is a primitive lake. However, the water level was really high, and it the current swift, and the only way to go up there is if you're an expert at poling, because paddling is just an impossible feat. We were all in our 20s and in good physical shape, paddling as hard as we could. We were looking at the same view for, you know, minutes on end, because we weren't going anywhere. So we hopped out of the canoes, tied ropes to them, and started walking upstream and pulling the canoes behind us. And eventually we just gave in to the fact that we weren't going to make it up to the Allegash Lake. And it took us less than 20 minutes going downstream to cover what it had taken us about 9 hours of trudging up against the current. And so at any rate, the following day we ended up making a portage over onto Eagle Lake, which is where our incident had happened. However, two nights earlier on the Lake Champlain, or Champagne there, at a campsite called Mud Pond, we had seen a strange light in the night sky. And it, to me, because we had been paddling into this strong headwind while trying to paddle up to the northern end of the lake, we had camped on the sheltered side of the camping area, and I thought this light was kind of strange. It was moving at about the pace and speed that you would see a hot air balloon drifting. And the odd thing about it was moving into the wind. It was on the opposite side of the lake from where we were. And we saw it for a few moments, and then it disappeared. That evening, however, it, you know, made no significant impression on us, as we had been on the lookout for two young boys who had been members of the other party camping in this campsite area that we too were camping at. And shortly after seeing this light, we spotted where these two young guys were, and so that was the end of the excitement for that evening, and we all turned in. Following day was when we tried to get up to Allegash Lake, and
Charlie,
after that...
Sorry to cut in here, but we are a little bit late for break here. So I'm just going to leave it that...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no problem. I'm just going to leave it that When we come back, we'll be talking about found the missing boys, and that was it for the night. And then, so everyone, hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages, and don't go away. All right, welcome back. My guest this evening is Charlie Foltz, and we're talking about the Allagash incident in Maine back, I think it was August 20th, if I recall, 1976.
1976.
Yeah, I was not that far off. That's good. So right before break, we were talking about the two missing boys, and you kind of just you hung it up for the night, and then you were about ready to start to talk about what happened the next day.
Well, right. The following day after we got our canoes loaded up, we tried going up to this primitive lake, which is Allagash Lake. It was more of a chore than it was in our time schedule that we were trying to keep. So after having tried all day to get up there without success, we then moved on to the next location, which was Eagle Lake. So you have to portage roughly a half a mile between the two lakes. You have to carry your canoes and all your gear and everything. Since there were four of us with two canoes, we lashed poles between the two canoes, and then two guys in the front, two guys in the back. We just lifted the canoes and took them from one point to the other and came back and repeated the process for the other canoe. Then got out onto Eagle Lake, where we had wanted to stay at a site on Pillsbury Island called Thoreau's campsite, where Henry David Thoreau had stayed when he had canoed through that area. There was a canoeist, perhaps a third of a mile or so ahead of us on the lake, and we were trying to beat him to that campsite, but with the lead he had, he got there before us, and we didn't want to share any more campsites, so we had a backup site at a place called Smith Brook campsite. And that was on the evening that we had our encounter. We set our camp up and put together a fire, then got our fishing gear together. Just as it was getting dark, we lit the fire, which we estimated would burn for pretty close to 3 hours, and started paddling across the lake toward the area where the stream flows into Smith Brook stream flows into Eagle Lake. There were a lot of dead standing trees and fallen trees in that area, so we figured it would be good structure for fish, and we wanted to add some fish, fresh fish, to our diet. Well, it had taken us probably a good 25 minutes or so to paddle, some 400 yards from the campsite through all of these deadfalls, and you couldn't go in a straight line because there were too many obstructions. And once we got settled in, It was fully dark, and the only point of reference for us for our campsite was the fire in the fire pit at the campsite. And we'd only been there fishing for maybe about 10 minutes when we heard Chuck Rack, this other fellow that was on the trip with us, and there was a tone of great concern in his voice, saying, "What the expletive is that?" We turned and looked in his direction, and the first thing I saw was this ball of light that I thought, well, it's a moon, you idiot. But no sooner had that thought entered and processed than I dismissed it as not being the moon at all, because it was moving above the treetops, perhaps about 15 or 20 feet, and it was moving straight down the shoreline in our direction. When it was maybe less than 300 feet from us, out of curiosity, I picked up a camp lantern, the type that has a handle with the push button.
Mm-hmm.
I put my hand over the lamp, turned the light on, and then in semaphore fashion, flashed three flashes, short, three long flashes, and then three short flashes.
SOS.
Just to see what this thing would do.
Mm.
And it's basically an SOS. And when I did that, this thing stopped. It was no longer continuing down the shoreline, but had completely stopped. Stayed there for, I don't know, with maybe 10 seconds or so. And then this beam of light appeared from somewhere on the bottom and hit the foliage and the reeds and things right at the shoreline, and started coming across the water in our direction, sort of like a spotlight. The characteristics of this light were very unusual, in as much as they had the characteristics and qualities of a glass tube, except that it was sort of like a neon blue in color. The size of the light was large enough that it could take in a large SUV easily. And as this thing was coming in our direction, we then quickly realized that this sphere of light, which was probably about the size of a 2.5-story house, was coming in our direction also. I dropped the flashlight and grabbed a canoe paddle and started canoeing as quickly as I could, paddling out of both sides of the front of the canoe in a straight line toward the campfire. My friends behind me, the twins, were using their hands, and they were paddling out of each side of the canoe and urging me to paddle as quickly as I could. We didn't know what this thing was, but we weren't as curious about it anymore as we had been a few minutes earlier.
Mm.
And then what seemed like a moment later, we were standing that is, Chuck Rack was sitting in the canoe, but Jack, Jim, and myself were standing on the shore. And I had this flashlight in my hand again. And this sphere was now, it seemed like it was close enough you could throw a stone or a baseball at it and hit it. And it was about 40 feet above the surface of the water. The night that this happened, there was no moon in the sky, but the sky was so brilliant with the Milky Way that the Milky Way, you know why it's called that if you ever see it in the night sky, a clear night sky, it is just vast. And it had been reflecting in the surface of the water. It was a calm, still night. The only thing you could hear were insects and the occasional loon. This sphere that had chased us back across the lake made no noise. It created no disturbance on the surface of the water, nor had it created any disturbance at the tops of the trees that it illuminated as it moved down the shoreline. The tops of the trees lit up from the ambient light that this sphere projected. I took the flashlight and flashed at it again, as I had while we were in the canoe, because now we're a little braver because we're on dry land and don't have the fear of drowning in the back of our minds. And you can always run through the woods, right? Yeah. So the sphere began moving, but this time it was moving away from us toward the opposite shoreline where we had first encountered it. When it got to the opposite side of the lake, it ascended up and away at a 45 degree angle from us. And for some reason, I felt that it was about to go fast. So I took the flashlight and looked at the sweep hand of my watch and then looked back at this sphere to see it literally accelerate so quickly that in less than 8 seconds, it had disappeared into the night sky. Mm. I noted the time on my watch was after 10 in the evening, and that this thing had made no noise whatsoever. Well, about that time, Chuck had joined Jack and Jim and I on the shore, and we all turned and walked back up to the campsite. Each campsite is an open area, a clearing in the main forest. It has a large fire pit specifically set up by the Park Service, as well as picnic tables and poles for drying wet clothing. And it also has the features of a toilet at each campsite. Well, we walked up and just all dropped down at the picnic tables. And I was about to sit down when I looked over at the fire and noticed that it had burned out. There were nothing but coals and little wisps of flame remaining of it. So I stirred it with a stick and asked everybody if I should throw some more wood on the fire. And everybody's response was, forget the fire, I'm turning in. And with that, each one of us then did turn in for the evening. We didn't sit around and talk about, you know, what this thing was or anything more about it. We didn't talk about having just escaped from it, you know, in fear of our lives. In retrospect, that was all kind of odd, because all we could talk about in the morning was this thing that had chased us across the lake.
Hmm. Wow.
We broke camp that morning. That was the only topic of discussion. And as we paddled up Eagle Lake toward our next campsite, we saw a ranger, and we called the ranger over. And we told him that we had seen a UFO, this huge sphere, this ball of light as big as a house, and that it had chased us, and that we had got away from it. Well, he gave us an incredibly hard look and sort of cocked his head and looked up at us and said in a heavy main accent that, well, what you boys saw were them Hollywood-style searchlights, and they opened up a brand-new hardware store in Millinocket and had them out front, and that's probably what you boys saw.
Do that
well,
perfectly.
Well, Millinocket.
That's a great
you.
Main accent.
Well, wow. Millinocket was about 90 miles south of where we were, and Mount Katahdin, which we had climbed a few days earlier, is, like I say, 1 mile high and in a direct line of sight from our campsite. Since there were no clouds that could bounce, or mirrors that could bounce light around, we didn't push it further with that ranger. And as we progressed on our trip, we kept informing rangers, and the more rangers we saw, the strangers the rangers treated us. Because they were pretty much looking out for us by the time we got to the end of the trip. So that being said, after 17 days canoeing the lakes, shooting the rapids, bypassing waterfalls, we finished our canoe trip in Fort Kent, which is the beginning and or end of U.S. Route 1, which was the first intercoastal state or interstate road, I believe, in the U.S., which it ran from Fort Kent all the way down to Key West, in Florida.
Right.
But we ended up driving back to Boston, and within a year we had shared our UFO encounter story about camping in the forest of Maine and being chased by a UFO, and got a lot of laughs from some of our girlfriends and some of our other friends. And, you know, after a year, we moved on with you know, life. I was finishing college, you know, each of us were going off in different directions. And about a dozen years later, Jim Weiner was being treated for an epileptic disorder, which resulted from an accident he sustained again in Maine about 2 years after our canoe trip on the Allegash. He was helping a friend who lives up in Perry, Maine, but at that time he was looking to buy a piece of property in Calais. These are areas in far northern Maine, and for those of you that are not familiar with Maine, it's a very large state, and is still covered from the ocean to the Canadian border in forest all over. And it's also an area where a lot of farmers grow crops. And so moving, before I digress, moving on forward with our lives, Jim was being treated for epileptic seizures. And at that time, he had moved back into Boston, where I was still living. After I had graduated from college, I worked as a medical artist and a clinical medical photographer in a teaching hospital, and worked with Harvard Medical School, Tufts, and BU Schools of Medicine. And Jim had gone on to become a ceramics instructor and teacher. He had taught in New Hampshire for a number of years, and was at the time teaching at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, where he taught ceramics as well. Jack, his identical twin, had married and lived in rural southern Vermont. And at the time Jim was being treated for epilepsy, both he and Jack were having nightmares, and the nightmares for them were quite terrifying, in so much as they were encountering creatures that they had no description way of expressing, their alarm by these dreams. But they were not talking, they were not communicating with one another about their dreams. Jack, who was married, was sharing these nightmares with his wife, because he would wake up in the middle of the night scaring her half to death. Jim, however, as I said, had moved back to Boston from teaching in New Hampshire. And I was living in a large house in the town of Brookline. And he moved in as one of my housemates. And in the middle of the summer, when it was the hottest, he began bolting his windows closed. We didn't have air conditioning or anything. And this four-bedroom apartment was on the top floor of this huge stucco house that had been built in the early 1920s. It had a terracotta tile roof, one of those like Spanish style curved red tile roofs. And when they get hot in the summertime, they radiate heat all night long.
Yeah.
And Jim was also, aside from bolting his windows closed, he was putting padlocks on the inside of his bedroom door.
Wow. I don't know if I ever heard that part.
And he was not sharing with the rest of his housemates his bizarre behavior.
Wow.
We did find it amusing in the morning while we were having a cup of coffee. He forgot to unbolt the door and walk straight into it on his way to the bathroom. So, but aside from the levity we had with that, we were, clueless as to why he was doing this.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to jump in for a break here. It's our last break. So we're going to...
Okay.
All right. So we're going to talk about... We're not going to talk about him running into the door, but we're going to talk about him locking the door when we come back. My guest is Charlie Foltz, and this is Martin Willis with Podcast UFO. That's actually it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll be back next week with John Greenwald. Remember, you can listen to the full shows for only $2 or more per month. All that information is on podcastufo.com. You can also make a yearly payment instead if that suits you better. And I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show and my guests, as well as thanking you for listening. Remember to keep your eyes to the sky.